we performed.
You just heard an excerpt of a work from the Wave Farm Broadcast Radio Art Archive. The archive aims to identify, coalesce, and celebrate historical and contemporary radio artworks created specifically for terrestrial broadcast. To learn more and listen to the work in full, visit wavefarm.org.
My name is Ginger Feldman from High and Mighty Therapeutic Riding and Driving Center, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Turn out on Tuesdays from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the WGXC Catskill Studio to learn about Wave Farm's WGXC, tour the studio, record a station ID or PSA, or pick up a sticker. The WGXC Catskill Studio is located at 393 Main Street in Catskill. Come on by for a visit and see how you can get involved in your local community radio station.
Wave Farm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Susanna Bradley of Tivoli, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
El patrocinio de WGXC es proporcionado en parte por la Asociación Olana, presentando el tercer jueves de cada mes un día de visitas guiadas y concluyendo con el programa artístico Melodías con Paisajes. Los visitantes pueden experimentar sonidos globales mientras contemplan los paisajes del Valle de Hudson. Este mes, el grupo afro-brasileño y de Caribe Heard World se presentará el jueves 21 de agosto de 12 a 19 horas. Todos están bienvenidos. Más información en olana.org/Third Thursdays.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. As we've reported, President Donald Trump said August 18th he would end the use of voting machines in the U.S., claiming without evidence they contributed to widespread election fraud. The same day, conservative media company Newsmax settled a defamation lawsuit for $67 million with Dominion Voting Systems for airing similar conspiracy theories. Trump said in a social media post he wanted to end the use of inaccurate, very expensive, and seriously controversial voting machines, echoing accusations he made leading up to the January 6th insurrection, when one Capitol Police officer was killed and 174 officers were injured. In May, Delaware Judge Eric Davis found sufficient evidence that Newsmax hosts and guests, including Trump campaign lawyers Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani, and Jenna Ellis, had repeatedly spread defamatory conspiracy theories that manipulation of Dominion Voting Systems machines resulted in widespread fraud. With a trial scheduled for October and the judge's ruling that the jury could consider actual malice, whether or not Newsmax executives knew the information was false and aired it anyway, they settled the case for $67 million. It's far less than the $787 million settlement with Fox News over similar claims. Newsmax said Dominion's suit was an attack on a free press. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. After Hurricane Helene caused devastation across the southern Appalachian Mountains last fall, Valentine Riley of Boone, North Carolina, sprang into action.
I found a generator. I got propane. I got bread, peanut butter, jelly, you know, food that would be easy for people to create without power. And then I headed straight to the state line.
To an indoor skateboard park called Zionville Ramp Company in the rural community of Trade, Tennessee. The owner, Ashley Gallagher, partnered with Riley to transform the skate park into the State Line Resource Station, a distribution hub for food, water, fuel, and other basic supplies. This helped meet people's immediate needs, but long-term recovery would require a lot more.
We have homes that were just completely wiped off the sides of mountains. It's rampant, the amount of damage that these storms did.
So the resource station partnered with a nonprofit to launch a grant program. It provides payments of up to $3,000 to help people rebuild. It's been almost a year since the storm, but some people are still struggling to get back in their homes, so grant applications continue to pour in.
As long as we're able to get funding, we want to be there to help.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Another goal was to provide jobs and trainings in renewable energy and to create a workforce that is ready. So, huge setback.
Julia Finch with the Kentucky Sierra Club says canceling $60 million in funding for the Solar for All program will slow job training and make it harder for low-income households to cut their bills. The state's coal industry praises the EPA cancellation, but consumer advocates point out that with the power rates rising sharply, wind and solar are now cheaper than fossil fuels. Finch says Louisville and Eastern counties had also planned community solar to aid disaster resilience. Immigrants in Fort Morgan, northeast of Denver, are turning to their community as asylum becomes harder to get and deportations ramp up. American Friends Service Committee organizer Guadalupe Lopez says she herself was detained, but now she's running trainings to help people navigate daily life.
Coming out of the trainings, people feel empowered and clear. Those tools are invaluable to people because it reduces their fear in their everyday life, driving their kid to school or the health clinic.
The Montana restaurant industry is helping employees learn how to deduct their tips. A provision in the Big Beautiful Bill lets servers deduct what could be a huge portion of their income. Brad Griffin is with the Montana Restaurant Association.
You still have to report all of your tips under federal law, but you will be able to deduct the first $25,000 off the top line as you file your income taxes.
Griffin says the biggest challenge is making sure their employees know they can claim it. The deduction expires in 3 years. Former Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown has launched a comeback bid running against Republican John Husted, who was named to replace now Vice President J.D. Vance. Brown says bad economic and health care conditions made worse by the GOP tax and budget mega bill pushed him back into the race.
I didn't really ever expect to run for office again. This rate system got worse. 490,000 Ohioans will lose health insurance. A huge tax cut driving a $3 trillion hole in the federal by the budget, and prices kept going up.
The race is expected to draw national attention and heavy outside spending with Senate control possibly on the line. Following a social media post by President Donald Trump, the Justice Department is opening an investigation into whether Washington, D.C. police manipulated crime data. In response to Trump federalizing district policing, the mayor and others cite data showing crime at a 30-year low. That takeover and aggressive Republican redistricting is sparking, quote, fight the Trump takeover protests in multiple places. Nearly 40 current and former national security officials have had their security clearances revoked by the Trump administration. Many investigated Russian interference in the 2016 election. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
An empire upon an empire.
I make no promises.
You on the mark.
With one purpose only. To point out and make public the dishonesty. Now in complete control of the government of this state.
There is only one man who can rid the politics of this state of the evil domination.
Yes. Hello.
Yeah! and welcome back to another edition of the Tuesday Afternoon Radio Show with your host, Randall Martin. So glad you could join us. And today, we're going to be talking about chamber music, among other things. And we're going to be talking with Wendy Sutter. She's the artistic director and founder of Chamber Music Churchtown. Wendy, how are you?
Pretty good. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on your show.
My pleasure. And, you know, I was so thrilled when I found out that you had did this huge undertaking. And yes, we were talking about it off air. You were telling me how you dreamed of doing a festival. You traveled and you made it happen. So
that's right.
before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about you. Let's okay. give the audience a little bit about your background and what brings you to this point.
Yeah, so I'm a professional concert solo cellist, having had a career of over 30 years playing in all the major halls around mm-hmm. the world. Think of Yo-Yo Ma Light, that's me.
Okay.
Light in the sense that I play the repertoire. I mean, not light in the sense that I'm playing different types of repertoire. It's just that there's only one Yo-Yo Ma in the world, and then there's the rest of us. I love Yo-Yo Ma. I know him well. He's a lovely guy. He's just saying that I do the same kind of work. So playing with orchestras as a soloist, recitals. Just recently, last week, played a solo recital at the Maverick Series in Woodstock.
Oh, nice.
So that's been my career. I mean, came into music, started playing the cello when I was 5 years old, and then by the age of 16 was at the Curtis Institute of Music, and then did my master's at the Juilliard School and, you know, started playing concerts professionally at the age of 21. And
wow, okay.
I'm 35 years later, so you can do the math. mm-hmm. And within that concert experience, you know, the summers, I would say for most classical musicians, is probably the most fun time for us because we get to play in these extraordinary venues, which usually are barns or wineries or, you know, more spaces connected with nature.
Okay.
But more, even more fun than that is that we get to see each other. So it's kind of like summer camp for kids, you know, so for musicians. So, yeah, so that's basically my career in a nutshell. It's maybe too vast to put into an interview, but yeah, I've worked with some prolific living composers and conductors of our time.
So what's that life like? You know, because you've trained for it, and you've kind of gone through all the, you know, the proper preemptory steps to get there.
Yes.
And now, what is the life like? What is that, like, a day in the life like for you when you know as you tour, as you go out? What does that look like?
It's pretty stressful, especially if you're, you know, a lot of it depends on where you're playing and what cities you're playing in, the conditions. Like, so if I'm playing in the Barbican or the Beaux-Arts in Brussels or Carnegie Hall, the pressure is obviously much more than, no offense to Arkansas, but like a concert hall, maybe a university setting, which can be actually sometimes more fun because the pressure is less.
Mm-hmm.
So it ebbs and flows depending on what you're doing. And, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm ever nervous about reviews or critics because that doesn't hold a lot of weight in the classical music business. Okay. But, you know, playing in front of an orchestra is stressful, more so than the audience in front of you, because you're playing in front of 80 people that know what they're listening to.
Okay.
And, you know, and don't forget, we're playing on instruments that aren't, you know, amped. These are all old wooden instruments. We're completely responsible for the sound and the tightrope walk that's involved with small finger execution. So it's very similar to being an athlete. It's not so much that we're practicing hours and hours a day, but the health and the physical capacity have to be in top form, you know. So even when I'm not performing a lot, I try to take very good care of myself physically and exercise and diet and all those things so that I'm in good mental and physical shape for when concerts do occur. So yeah,
and
I don't know if
music,
that answers the question, but yeah.
Yeah, and the music is like, it's very exacting. It's not like, you know, I play jazz and I play funk and R&B, and you can, you know, you there's a fair, especially with jazz, there's a lot of improvising. R&B, you know, quite some, you know, there's quite some, and you can kind of do your own thing in certain moments. That's not really the case for orchestral music. Like, it's pretty rigid. Like, you have to play the notes as written.
Yeah, we have private improvisations. But the scores, yeah, we stay true to the score. I mean, we honor what was written. You know, we're mostly playing old music. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do work with a lot of living composers too, but there, if when in times of, you know, let's say accidents, mistakes can happen. At this level, you can disguise them in a way that only your colleagues would know, but the audience would never have any, you know, awareness of that. But so we like to say, like, you know, private improvisations.
Well, but, I see that. I see.
We're never going off script. That makes sense. I mean, there was a tradition in early, you know, Baroque music and into early classical music and Mozart, et cetera, where the performer was expected to write their own cadenza, meaning that's kind of the period of the piece where the musician plays alone, gets to show off, right? And that tradition has been lost over the last 200 years. Some players like to do it, but 200 years ago, the performer, like me, I would have been expected to have written my own cadenza in a concerto. So that was the chance, that was the opportunity for a musician in those days to show off their compositional chops, you know. And I think in that space, you could improvise a bit if you wanted to. But that's like an added pressure to a performer now. I think a lot of us would be terrified to write something on our own, you know. But some performers are doing that. But in general, no, we stay true to the script. It's like reading Shakespeare or something. You wouldn't mess with the language per se if I'm playing a piece up until the middle of the 20th century, basically.
I have two part questions.
Yeah.
The process is, I had a young pianist from Ukraine on. Quite talented young lady. She's telling us about, she's in her 20s, but she'd gone through the whole process of, you know, of specific schools and training. And she says it's very competitive. In those things. And she always did well, but she said, you know, it's collegial, but it's very competitive in the background.
I think so. I mean, if you look at the percentage of musicians, I mean, even coming out of like Curtis and Juilliard, the probably the two top conservatories in the world, you know, there's less than 1% jobs waiting for these graduates. So there's a lot of fear and a lot of worry about that. But I'm really in awe nowadays of how the younger generation is has really learned how to manipulate social media and really do a lot of self-branding and find new ways of making careers. And I was in school and we didn't have cell phones and was still getting contracts, you know, on typewritten contracts. So there was no way of really self-branding besides just your networking between professionals and things. So social media is fantastic for that. And YouTube, I mean, young students can put up their work. You know, they don't have to go through an agent or a recording label for people to see their work. So in many ways, the field is much better now because of that. And my generation, we were waiting for the phone call. We were waiting for an agent to call us. You know, there was, and we, or, you know, we had cassette tapes back then. So, you know, you couldn't, even when the CDs came out, you couldn't make a CD yourself, you know. So a lot of it was just done through word of mouth or winning competitions, but winning competitions never guaranteed any kind of career for anyone. I mean, it was much harder. It is competitive, but I don't, you know, I think anything that a person commits to will, at this kind of level, if it's sports or science or medicine, when you're this passionate, this committed to it, you'll find a natural, you know, healthy order of competition. In my schools, nobody was out to get each other. In other words, you know, we were supportive of each other and were in it together. You know, if you want to put it that way, we were very supportive of each other. And in fact, my friends that I went to conservatory with are still my closest friends to this day, because when you're kind of living that experience together, it really bonds you, you know. But I can't say that there was any like direct competition of trying to get at each other or right. be aggressive.
Well, it's rigorous. Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of rigor. It's a lot of
we'd inspire each other with, you know, you'd walk down the quarters and hear other people practicing, like, oh my God, like someone's really doing a great job of that piece. So you better believe I want to play that piece
right,
as well.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
So it was healthy competition. Yeah.
Right.
Good old fashioned healthy competition. Yeah.
So professionally,
and I still
is it
feel
the
that
same
today.
Way?
I still check out what my colleagues are doing 30 years later, you know?
Really?
Yeah. There's still good healthy competition in that regard. Or it can be inspiring, you know, to see what. And maybe not so much even in playing anymore because we've all presented ourselves. We all have good, strong histories and performance now. But, you know, just kind of what people are doing in the way of projects or here we are building a festival or, you know, doing how they pivoted their work into something else. And so I think competition is, you know, healthy and can be very inspiring. Yeah.
Now, has your work evolved over time? Like the way that you would play something.
Oh yeah, I mean we're human beings, so like.
Is it the same?
Oh yes,
today?
I mean we're human beings, so you know a piece that speaks to me now. Maybe when I was 18 years old, I might have found just horrible. You know, like I remember I played the Rachmaninoff cello sonata at age 20 in a class at Juilliard, and I was asked to play it because it was for a class on romanticism and impressionism and music. And it was so funny because, I mean, I love this piece now. It's just one of the most stunning pieces of the cello repertoire. But when I was 20, it made me gag. I found it so overly sentimental and so romantic. In fact, I had these notes in my score like, okay, just push this phrase and, you know, to the death, like I was making fun of the piece, in other words, you know. And now when I look back on those notes, I was like, what was I thinking, you know? I mean, this piece is gorgeous, but when I was 20, I didn't find that kind of sentiment beautiful at all. I found it like really overdone. And so you change. Yeah, you change a lot. And music changes. I mean, the fashion of music changes too. Music that was very popular when I was at conservatory is not so popular now. Like, we were all really deeply invested in Schoenberg and Webern, and we loved the 12 system, the composers that were doing that, and Berg. And I don't have students coming to me wanting to play that music now. So it goes in and out of fashion, you know. So... yeah, certain things come, like, you'll hear, students will hear Yo-Yo do a great performance of a piece, and then they all want to study it, you know, that's a great example. Yeah, yeah.
So it kind of moves from, while it's not popular culture, but if it's in the sort of, in the
within our community,
in the environment.
You definitely see things coming in and out of fashion, absolutely, yeah. Within the classical community and even the program you see at Lincoln Center and things, you see like how, oh, this year everybody's about tango, or this year's everybody's about, you know, Florence Price, or, you know, you see these themes being kind of repeated throughout the community, even globally. So, and also you have to remember that a conductor might be doing like a certain symphony of a composer, and then that person is going to be repeating that symphony in many, many orchestras around the world. So the piece naturally has a, you know, creates a theme globally. So
now are there particular conductors that you like to play with, or is it all of them? Is it, you know,
No. I would get in trouble if I dropped names.
Okay. I thought about as I was asking the question.
There's a few that I like.
Okay.
You know, I'm going to get really in trouble for this, but just remember this. Conductors don't make any sound.
Right.
Right. Leave it there.
Well, and they're setting the tempo, right? They're setting the tempo.
Oh, they're doing
a
lot. I mean, a good one is doing, actually, I mean, they're carving the piece.
Yes.
Doing a lot more. I mean, hopefully they're showing with their technique a good tempo, obviously. That's not really ultimately what we need. I mean, a conductor for a large orchestra is there really just to keep people together, right? Because there's sight lines, we can't see each other, but we can hear each other. In all truth, the New York Philharmonic, Boston Symphony, they could easily play a concert without that guy on the podium, easily. But because it's a large ensemble and the acoustics and the sight lines, some things would be a little risky. But okay, let's just say that a lot of times the concertmaster is really leading the orchestra, the first violinist. He is almost more important than the conductor. He is the leader of the orchestra. So if there's a conductor who's on the podium who's not doing such a great job, everyone reverts to the concertmaster. And he's really the CEO of the orchestra. So
I didn't know that. And so the first violinist is the go-to. That's what you're listening to.
Absolutely. And there have been some conductors, I would say more so in Europe, that I've worked with that have just blown my mind. And I think of them like teachers, you know, like really astute musicians that can kind of change my thinking about Beethoven or phrasing and Schubert and things. But conductors are no, and again, I'm getting in trouble, they're no more special than another colleague, like talking to another violinist or whatever. We're just musicians, you know. So a conductor has an odd job where they have to get the control of like 80 people in front of them very quickly. So it's more of a psychological experience, you know.
Are they like a coach?
Yes. They would like to be like a coach. They would like to be like a coach, okay. Yes. Now, you also have to think that most professional orchestras have played the repertoire so many times. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say Beethoven Fifth Symphony. How many times has a violinist in the Boston Symphony of 30, 40 years played that piece? Too many to count, right? So a new conductor comes to the podium and they're like, we're doing the Beethoven Fifth Symphony. This violinist is probably not going to be very interested in what this guy has to say about it, right? So it takes a lot for that conductor to get that violinist to perk up and listen or find something interesting, you know, in that symphony, something different. So the pressure on a conductor to bring the attention of the orchestra is magnificent, because most professional orchestras, again, can play that symphony on their own, you know, very, very well. So, I mean, Leonard Bernstein was a great artist. So I never got to work with Leonard Bernstein, but I have a couple of friends who did, who were actually even hired by him at the New York Philharmonic. And the reverence and the admiration with which they speak about him is just unsurpassed. I've never heard that about any other living conductor.
Now, when, you know, when they're conducting, like you look at it and you're looking at the, you know, the hand movements it seems to me like just the slightest variations, the slightest gesticulation of their hands, you have to be responsive to that, right? Even though you know what you're playing
they're carving the sound. They're kind of, you know, showing the architecture as they're going along. And their hands or their baton those are the only tools they really have, and their eyes look at us, portray an emotion, you know, to grab your attention. That's what they have to kind of carve the direction of the phrasing. Yeah. So generally, I would say most musicians would say that less is more. The less they do, the more. It's like a parent, right? The more you scold a child, the less they're going to listen. So the more they move around, that doesn't have anything to do with the music making, you know.
Really? Some of that's from the just audience theatrics. Perspective, that's what you think.
It's good for the audience. It's not so good for the audience. It's entertainment. But
Okay.
For us, it can be a little nauseating. You know? Because we want a good parent. We want a good driver. We just want to see A to B where they're going. And a lot of that theatrical stuff just messes it up, you know. So, but my life has not centered around conductors. That working as a soloist and chamber musician, I get to drive the car myself. So conductors are not the center of my life. I don't play in an orchestra full-time, so that's not something that I, you know, work with on a regular basis.
Now, do you work with the same people often, or is it just, you know,
it's a small world. The classical music world is a kind of a small world. So yes, I have colleagues all over the world that basically I went to school with, and then you, you know, or you meet them at festivals or concerts and you become friends. And so I'm always delighted to see when I'm invited to play somewhere, like the roster of who I get to play with. I mean, this is now in a chamber music situation, and that's also a good thing to bring up about my festival, because of course I'm bringing my favorite people in the world to come play with me in Hudson Valley. And, you know, so it's always very exciting. And it's, again, it's like teamwork, right? So I can see someone on a festival I'm about to go to, oh, that's great. Like, he or she and I play together so well. And this other person, you know, their playing is great, but they could be annoying in rehearsals. You know, it's just like teamwork. So
this is what I'm getting to. I'm getting to that synergy. You know, like, if you're always playing with different people, it's hard to have a synergistic relationship. But when you play with the same people, you then you kind of can ebb and flow and respond off each other in a particular way.
Absolutely. I mean, it could be corporate, you know, this is true for anything in the world, right? And corporate works, sports, again, like just people coming together, you know, like some people you work better with than others, you know, I mean, some people, like I have a violinist that I play with a lot, then it's unspoken. We just play together. It's so flawlessly, you know, and don't have to talk about things, and it's just you know it's like jazz, right? Some people just like you vibe together, and those experiences are fantastic. And I mean, I'm very confident to say that the players that I'm bringing to Hudson, to the Churchtown Dairy, are selected for that reason, because we just have great chemistry together and enjoy each other, and the work is easy when the chemistry is there. So,
absolutely.
And I know they'll bring down the house. So that's really good.
All right. So you got some ringers in there. You know you picked the cream of the crop.
Absolutely.
For what you
absolutely
need.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we again, like in any situation, you always want to work with the best, right? And because then it makes things easier and less stressful, and you feel that confidence, you know, like this is going to be a great performance, because you can also take risks with people like that. You have the security, like I can go a little to the left and they'll just go right with me, you know, on stage. And so it makes it really fun as well. I mean, left, like in the phrasing, you know.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. Now, but also now you with organizing this whole thing, you've taken on an additional, because are you playing in this?
Oh, yes. Okay, so, well, last year I took a little time off from performing because I did a weird thing. I enrolled in the, it's called the LEAD program through the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And
okay.
I had been running I was the artistic director of another festival in Litchfield County for 3 seasons.
Okay.
Not a festival that I created, but I was, they approached me to take over the festival, the chamber music festival in Litchfield County, and I was like, okay, sure. I mean, why not? Let's see how that goes. And under my leadership, that festival did very well. It tripled its revenue in 1 year. I mean, I was just bringing up, again, my friends from the city, from Lincoln Center Chamber Music Society, New York Phil, Metropolitan Opera, you know, and bringing these first-tier musicians, I mean, first-class musicians in the world to a church in Washington, Connecticut. So, you know, they were very happy about that. Now, I no longer run that. I'm no longer in the artistic director of that festival because, you know, these organizations, they have boards. And I knew within that, I wasn't given full artistic control, and which is a little strange because I was the only musician in a leadership position.
Okay.
So I left. I just thought that was ridiculous. You know, there was bans on certain composers and, anyway, in leaving that festival, but I had this assembly of musicians that were happy to come up and play. And, you know, and so it was like, I had this troupe of musicians like, well, where are we going to go? We love that, playing with you up there. So my sister who lives in the Hudson Valley said, let me drive you around Hudson Valley and show you some venues, which, because I think you should, you know, find a new home for your players. And so the first place she took me to was the Churchtown Dairy, and it was just love at first sight. I walked into the Round Barn, which is this just kind of architectural jewel of a place, and I was like, this is it. If there's parking, people can walk right from their cars into the barn. It's all wood. The acoustics I knew would be phenomenal, and there was about 300 people in the barn listening to someone speaking about organic bean farming. And I thought, well, if there's 300 people here, and no offense to farming, but listening to that, could you imagine what would happen if I brought in some Tchaikovsky or Schubert? You know, you know. So that's where the idea. That's when the idea popped. Or I gave the idea came on that afternoon, and then I decided, you know, I really want to kind of boss up and get some business acumen. I'm a really good musician, but it would be fun to study something else, and I want to start a festival from the ground up, and I want it to be entirely mine, you know, with no, you know, bartering about who's, what composers I can program, et cetera, et cetera. So I did this, signed up and did an application for this leadership program, which is all online through the graduate school of business at Stanford. I figured I'd go for the best. And so I took some time off this last school year, which is also the same as a season in music, to devote myself to this program, which has just been out of this world. I wish I had done this like 20 years ago. I'm working, you know, studying with some of the foremost economists and basically like psychologists, because we're talking about economic behavior and things in the world. And their focus really is on innovation and trying to encourage the students, most of which are like mid-level in their career, you know, looking for promotions to C-suite positions, to start things on their own. So I'm the oddball in this program. You know, my teammates have master's MBAs already, or high up in tech, or working at Google, and I'm the weird musician. But I use the Churchtown Dairy for a model for my homework assignments.
Okay.
Like 75% of my homework assignments, I'm like, there's the dairy and there's the musicians and this is my, you know, financial model. And my teachers loved it. Some of my teammates were like, oh my God, here she goes about this dairy again.
But consistency is important.
Like, what is she talking about? But the most interesting thing about this story actually is that, you know, I fell in love with this space. I knew it would work, but I couldn't figure out who to contact about using the Round Barn for concerts. So I was writing to the head manager, kind of the head farmer and manager of the farm, and literally getting responses like, hey, I don't have time to talk to you about this. I am so busy making hay right now. Like, you need to go away.
Okay.
Literally getting this kind of, like, I can talk to you maybe in 8 weeks, you know, but I don't, basically showing zero interest. And now this guy and I are quite close, and it's funny to think back on it. So I was losing hope in this beautiful idea. And part of me was like, do I need to just go there with my cello and go into the barn and just play and show them, you know? But I happened to be playing a recital up in White Plains, New York in the spring, and there was someone there that was speaking to me after the concert. He told me he lived in Philmont, New York. I said, of course, you know, I asked him immediately, do you know this Churchtown Dairy? And he said, oh, yeah, Abby Rockefeller's dairy. And I was like, what? Abby Rockefeller built that dairy? And he said, yeah. And I had no idea. I didn't see her name anywhere on the, you know, the websites that I was looking at.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
I know her brother. So I was like, oh my goodness, this is incredible. Because I know David Rockefeller Jr. a bit. He's had me play concerts at his home in the city. And I went to his wedding like 15 years ago. So, you know, I called him and I said, look, David, I have this idea. What do you think? He said, I think it's great. I think Abby would love it, you know. So based on his blessing and his endorsement, then I wrote her a pitch, an email, very carefully drafted pitch. And it turned out that she had also been a cellist, which was also another win-win for me. She had studied cello at the New England Conservatory, and then after school went into different areas of work in humanities, women's rights, and ecology, et cetera. So I wrote her this pitch, and then within 5 minutes I had an email back from her, and she said, let's do it. And that was one of the best days of my life.
So persistence really paid off, but you also...
I think it's really like, You know, it's like when you have a dream that's this strong and a passion, things click, and things keep clicking. Like the karma, everything's working. It's just happening very, very quickly, because I think I got that letter from Abby in May, and then it was like, okay, should we just do a pilot event? Like, and I was like, well, I don't really want to raise the money to do a private event. Why don't I do a concert with tickets? And then once I was able to assemble this core of musicians at the end of the summer, because everyone was already booked.
Gotcha.
My sister said, who's very, very, very smart, she said, well, I don't understand. If you're getting all the musicians up there for a Friday, why are you only doing one concert? Let's do two, you know. Let's do them on Saturday, another one on Saturday. So now we do have two concerts, but, you know, I put the nonprofit into place. I started the business. I've been doing all the fundraising, developing the programming, the marketing. I mean, everything on my own. Meanwhile, playing five other festivals myself this summer. So
okay, that's a
lot. It's been a very, very, very busy and very little sleep summer, but incredible excitement. And I tell my friends, like, you know, it's kind of like you want to get pregnant, and then all of a sudden you find out you're pregnant, and the baby's coming in 2 months, not 10 months. That's what this feels like to me. But the baby's coming. It's in motion. So I'm so blessed to have such a great sister who's extremely organized and very savvy, and who lives in Hudson, understands the community really well. And that's been such a great blessing. And I have been able to hire two other people to now kind of help with the marketing and the graphics and things like that. I was doing everything on my own, building the website by myself. I don't know anything about building a website, you know, but it's like the determination, the passion was just keeps me going. And I really believe that this festival has the capacity to be one of the great festivals on the East Coast because of the structure, the architectural beauty of the round barn. All the wood is just makes it an acoustical jewel of a place. Like, it wasn't built to be a concert hall, but I think it is a concert hall and could be one of the best concert halls I've ever stepped or played in. When I played my cello the first time, that was just, it's mind-boggling how beautiful the acoustics are in there. And so it's just super exciting. And also, you know, there's a little bit of a vacuum in the Hudson Valley. Like, there's great festivals all along the eastern, you know, Tanglewood and Marlboro and so many. And when I saw the Dairy, I was like, why is there not a festival in this area? There's so many New Yorkers here, and, you know, it's 90 minutes from the city. And I just felt like this area was crying for a festival. So it's happening.
Well, you know, I love this line on your website, and it's Chamber Music Churchtown. And as you describe it in the About page, you said, festival is grounded by the same principles that both shape chamber music and this place: listening, balance, reciprocity, and stewardship.
Yes.
And I really thought that was just such a lovely sentiment about a musical event.
Yeah, that's inspiration. That line came to me on an Amtrak trip from going tour back from the city to Hudson. And when I was putting down the literature for the website, that line came to me, and I was just like, bingo, that's it. You know, that's inspiration.
It's
and because, you know, Abby and I have yet to meet in person, but we're very much in touch, and her whole passion is about ecology and soil. And she actually brought the compost toilet to America from Sweden in the 1970s. That's the first thing she told me about. And she's extremely passionate about this. So I was trying to think of like things like the earth and things that, you know, like the foundations of music, the same. And it's been just incredibly moving for me to spend time on the Dairy. I'm not a farmer. I mean, I didn't grow up on a farm. My whole life has been, I grew up in Seattle. And then been in apartments since the age of 16 on my own in Philadelphia or New York. And I have a dog, but I don't know anything about cows or, you know, and I've been spending a lot of time with these cows. It's a working dairy. And they are just gorgeous. I mean, they're so noble. And this is a very cute piece of trivia as well. I'm walking through, you know, where they milk the cows in the morning, and there's a a new litter of fresh baby calves, and they named one Wendy, and they didn't even hadn't even met me yet. So I was like, this meant to be.
So you have a deep connection here. That is, it's not just
really
another
connected.
Venue.
But the space is just, and it's just visually so stunning to look at, and also the acoustics in there are just so magical. And I'm just counting the days to having these six musicians come up in the city and step foot and experience the love affair that I've had for almost 10 months now. I know they will. And Abby has been so generous towards us with, you know, letting us just kind of do what we want with the space, and the staff at the Dairy as well. It's just been remarkable.
I'm curious, now, how did your business schooling?
I'm actually still in school. I have homework due on Wednesday.
So how did that play into it? What did you learn that you didn't know that surprised you as you're taking your business leadership journey at the same time as you're planning the foundations of this festival?
I think the big takeaway from this Stanford program will be this course I'm in actually right now called Power, and learning about power. And Jeffrey Pfeffer, who's one of the world's most famous economists, has written about 8 books on this. And and like learning that power is just power. It's not good or bad, but you know, doing a lot of case studies about people, including our current president, about people who go into power, who are what they've done to achieve power. You know, he's given us quite a few very, let's see, what's the word? Courageous assignments, getting you out of your comfort zone.
Okay.
You know, signing a task like this week, I want you to reach out to 10 people who you would feel intimidated to reach out to. And then write back on how that went, you know, and so you have to journal and write about these encounters. That has been so timely with building this festival, especially right now where I'm in the apex of it, you know, just contacting people that I might have felt shy to contact, especially in regards to fundraising. And it's all going very well. Like, no one said no to me. He's like, you know, the more you do it, and he talks about practicing, he actually alludes to music and sports a lot. The more you do it, the less scary these things become, you know? And I'm like, well, I got that down. You know, I know about that. Not that performing ever becomes less scary, but it's more familiar. Like, I know how to handle the fear on stage now because I've been doing it for so long. So when he brought that in, like, the more you practice, the more confident you'll become, which seems kind of obvious. But asking people for money or reaching out to philanthropists and things can feel daunting, you know. The more I do it, the less now I don't have any emotionality about it. Like, I don't care anymore, you know. What's the worst someone can do is they can say no. But generally, I feel, you know, this story is strong. It's good. And I'm bringing something of really high cultural value to people and concerts. It's not like I'm asking money for a new car, right? So, and I think especially in this day and age, this kind of thing is even more important right now. So I would say that this power course has been really fascinating. And we've had to analyze like congressional talks without any volume and just see the power dynamics between people in a room and, yeah, what else can I say about that? Also doing like a 30-minute, you know, 30-minute pitches to get a point across, 30-second, excuse me, things that are outside of what I would do as a cellist. Making a video of yourself is very different from playing a concert. You know, I thought that doing a presentation, even if it was myself speaking, would be easy, but it's quite different from playing a concert. So I have a lot of respect now for CEOs or people in business that have to do these kind of pitches. Difficult.
It is a
and
different skill set.
And also just getting this, having these fantastic teammates who are in different areas of work has also been really, really helpful for me. A lot of when I'm doing one-on-one feedback with a guy who might be working at Google or doing tech, he's like, Wendy, you got to get to the point quicker, you know, when you're selling yourself and things. So Yeah, it's been fascinating. It's basically psychology, really, at the end of the day, you know.
It's
trying to persuade, negotiate, sell, you know.
Right, but it's different than musical psychology. Like, you musicians,
yeah.
Like, there's a level of grace when you're dealing with different musicians and the kind of – that power dynamic, it's there, or it can be there, but it's different. And everyone brings their own kind of level of individuality to that situation. Different than in business, though. Business is – more distinct levels,
much
of
more
power.
Direct, and people aren't as uncomfortable about talking about money. I mean, I'm in a profession where, you know, we're not going to ever see the decimals going to the billions, right? Which is the kind of money I'm talking about in school. Like my first class in financial evaluation, you know, where I'm doing spreadsheets and evaluating companies or pretending to be a CEO for Google and telling my colleagues at Google whether or not we should stay in China as if it's 2010. I mean, I was a fish out of water. I was like, oh my God, what is an Excel spreadsheet? You know, I don't know how to do this. So needless to say, I was not sleeping or eating very much that first quarter. I would liken it to somebody saying, you know, getting into a graduate program of composition at any school without knowing how to read music, you know, and you're given an assignment like analyze this fugue, you have 4 days, you know, that's what it felt like to me when I first started Stanford. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, but luckily I had teammates who kind of carried me along and, you know, helped me out. It was pretty terrifying at first. But when I would first see these financials for certain companies that I had to analyze, and I see 3.0 or 4.2, and I was like, well, I didn't know what that was. And then, oh no, they're talking about billions of dollars. Like, those numbers don't really come into the music field. You know?
Right. The music field just doesn't resonate. It doesn't make sense. Well, I always found, like, I run a company and you know, and I play music. But they're two different worlds. And in my company, I have no problem articulating, you know, what I need, what I'm worth, what's, you know, what I have to get, the way it has to be. Music is different from me because it is a labor of love. It is worth something. It has a value. But I always try to a little bit shy away from it because it's like, if I'm going to come and I'm going to play, I'm going to play because I love it. I'm going to give it my all. If I get paid, you know, $100, $200, $1,000 less or $1,000 more, it's not necessarily going to change, you know, what I'm going to do.
And
I'm still going to love
company,
the music and give it to you.
Yeah, and 30 people aren't going to lose your job if you have their jobs if you have a bad. Your corporation's not going to collapse.
That's true. That is true, and that's something.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it too. Like, I see like crisis management and finance now and stuff. I mean, they put me in these situations where I have to pretend to be like, okay, I'm this, you know, CFO of a company, and we're not making products anymore in Asia. Sounds familiar, right? China. So, what should you do? You know, what are you going to advise your employees to do, Wendy? You know, any young musician could really benefit from doing some form of business training because I have learned so much at this age. And again, I wish I had done this. And just about kind of branding and marketing and networking. I mean, those things do come into play a lot as being a musician. I mean, we are branding ourselves all the time, just naturally, right? But the, you know, I think it's just, again, taking the emotionality. I'm way less scared to just come up to someone now and be like, hey, I need to talk to you about this, you know, and it works. It's, you know, I have a long history. I have a long experience in this world, and I have a lot of value to bring to another, you know, I have cred, basically. So it's given me a lot of courage to do things that I wouldn't have done before.
So you've grown through this process.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. 1,000%. Yes. 1,000%.
So we're coming up toward the end, but I really want to get into, tell our audience and me, tell us about the experience. What can we expect during your event?
Well, first of all, you're going to hear, you know, some of the greatest chamber musicians in the world. I'm bringing them up from, these are musicians from Orion String Quartet, from the Metropolitan Principals from Metropolitan Opera, from Lincoln Center Chamber Music Society. They have Grammys. They have Avery Fisher Career Grant Awards. Resumes don't get any better. And they're my friends. And they're very supportive and excited about this new festival. So, and being a part of the inaugural concerts, you're going to hear, you know, the meat and potato repertoire of Dvorak American String Quartet, Tchaikovsky's Souvenir de Florence, which is a sextet. The second night will be Brahms G major, G minor sextet, which is stunning, and then the Schubert Cello Quintet. I wanted to do things with two cellos in recognition of Abby because she's a cellist and I'm a cellist, and I knew that she would immediately love this, the idea of this repertoire. And also these pieces fit, not to sound corny, but really well with nature. You know, the Dvorak American String Quartet, he is inspired by hymnals and spirituals that Dvorak heard when he came to America in the late 19th century. Uh-huh. And I have a young cellist, Matthew Christakos, who's, I call him my cello son. He's not my son, but he's only 24 years old, and he's the new assistant principal, youngest assistant principal cellist at the New York Philharmonic ever. Also a graduate of the Curtis Institute of Music, which is my training. And so that's really exciting to see Matt at such an early stage of his like incredible career. And the concerts won't be too long. We're not going to torture you. And there will be wonderful wines from the Hudson Chatham Winery there. And, you know, even if I know people will love these concerts, but for some reason, if you don't, you can look at the cows and enjoy the scenery.
I think it's going to be wonderful. And this is
going to be wonderful.
August 29th. And August 30th, right?
Both yes, at 6 p.m. The space only seats 250 people, so we're really encouraging.
You want to get
the
tickets?
Selling quickly.
And I'm looking at your website, and that's chambermusicchurchtown.org.
Yes.
And so I can't wait. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there.
You better be there.
Yes, I promise. I'll be there. So it's coming up. Hey, we got 1 minute left. What do you have to say before we go? I'm going to give you the last word, and then we got to go to a tune. Wendy, what do you want to tell people?
Again, I just really look forward to, you know, meeting more of the community, and that can only happen if you come to the concerts. And hopefully, next summer we're looking at doing 8 concerts. So thank you so much for the interview. Really appreciate it.
You are very welcome. So great talking to you. And
likewise.
Again, that's August 29th and August 30th. This is Randall Martin, and don't go anyplace.
FM, WGXC. Like good old tap water. Just turn it on and get it.
My name is Rip Van Wagner from the lovely village of Catskill, and you're listening to WGXC, ACRA, Catskill and More, 90.7 FM.